A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And Hannah, we know you're listening, so hi. He's in the middle of a house move, packing up his home office, cables and specific parts of the box, everything labeled so it reassembles cleanly on the other side. And he's noticed something. When he's doing this kind of mundane, low-stimulation task, he needs the house completely empty to get through it efficiently. Not just the room, the whole house. Hannah could be silently doing her own thing in the kitchen, and his brain still won't fully commit to the task. He's got ADHD. He knows context shifting is hard for him, and he's asking, is this just a me thing? Or something everybody experiences at some level?
The thing he's really asking underneath the neuroscience question is, does needing my wife to not exist for 2 hours mean something about how much I love her? Because it doesn't feel great to admit that.
I love you. Please vacate the premises so I can sort cables. It's not a Hallmark card. But it's also not coldness. It's a specific cognitive demand that his brain is making. And I think a lot of people feel this and immediately pathologize it instead of understanding what's actually happening.
What is actually happening? What's the mechanism that makes a silent person in another room feel like a barrier to focus?
Before we get into the mechanics, let's name the phenomenon, because it's not just distraction in the usual sense. Daniel's not saying Hannah is interrupting him, she's doing her own thing. The problem is that his brain knows she's there, and that knowledge alone consumes something.
This is what the cognitive neuroscience literature calls anticipatory cognitive load. Your prefrontal cortex maintains what are called task sets, the neural configurations that let you execute a specific activity. When you're alone in the house, your brain can dedicate essentially all of its working memory capacity to the boring task in front of you. But the moment another person is present, even silently, your brain opens a secondary monitoring thread. It's holding capacity in reserve for potential social interaction.
A monitoring thread. So it's like leaving a browser tab open that you're not actively using, but it's still eating RAM.
And the research suggests this consumes roughly 10 to 15% of working memory capacity even when no interruption actually occurs. You're not being interrupted, you're just permanently ready to be interrupted. That readiness itself is the drain.
Which explains why alone in the house feels qualitatively different from alone in a room with someone else in the house. The monitoring thread doesn't care about walls, it cares about presence.
For most neurotypical people, that 10 to 15% overhead is measurable but manageable. Studies show it adds about 10 to 15% to task completion time. Annoying, but you can still function. For an ADHD brain, the same condition can prevent task initiation entirely. It's not a difference of degree, it's a difference of whether the engine starts at all.
Let's sit with that for a second, because I think this is where Daniel's question about, is this just me, really lands. The neurotypical experience is, this is harder with someone around. The ADHD experience is, this is impossible with someone around. Same mechanism, completely different severity.
The reason comes down to dopamine signaling in the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is what manages task sets, switches between them, and suppresses irrelevant ones. In ADHD brains, dopamine transmission in this region is reduced. Dopamine is essentially the neurotransmitter that says, this task is worth sustaining attention on. When the signal is weak, the brain is constantly scanning for something more stimulating. Adding a social monitoring thread on top of that, even a silent one, can be the difference between engaging the task and not engaging it.
We've got the universal mechanism. Everyone's brain opens a monitoring thread when another person is present. And we've got the ADHD-specific severity. When your dopamine signaling is already making it hard to lock onto a boring task, that extra 10 to 15% overhead doesn't just slow you down. It prevents the lock from happening.
This is where hyperfocus comes in, because hyperfocus is the ADHD brain's workaround for the dopamine problem. When a task is stimulating enough, or when conditions are exactly right, the brain can flip into a state where the default mode network, that's the mind-wandering, self-referential network, gets suppressed, and the task-positive network dominates. You get lost in the task. You're productive in a way that almost looks like a superpower from the outside.
Daniel's not in hyperfocus packing gables. And the key thing about hyperfocus that most people get wrong is that it's not something you can summon at will. It's a state that occurs under specific environmental conditions. The presence of another person creates what researchers call a permeable boundary around the focus zone. Your brain never fully disengages the social monitoring system, so the default mode network never fully suppresses, and hyperfocus never initiates.
There was a meta-analysis published in January this year in Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews that looked at exactly this. ADHD brains during task switching show about 40% greater activation in the anterior cingulate cortex compared to neurotypical controls. The ACC is involved in error detection and conflict monitoring. It's the part of your brain that says something changed, pay attention. In an ADHD brain, that system is working overtime. Every potential interruption, even one that hasn't happened yet, triggers a bigger neural response.
40% more activation just to manage transitions. That's not a preference. That's hardware.
It's hardware. And it explains why Daniel's experience isn't about willpower or just ignoring Hannah. The anticipatory load isn't a conscious choice. It's an automatic process in the ACC and prefrontal cortex that consumes resources regardless of intention. You can't decide not to monitor for social cues any more than you can decide not to hear a loud noise.
Let's talk about the task itself, because I think that's the other half of why this particular scenario is so revealing. Daniel's packing cables. This is not deep creative work. It's not problem solving. It's categorization decisions. Which cable goes with which device? How to coil them so they don't tangle? Which section of the box they belong in? It's too complex for pure autopilot, but too boring for engagement. It's the ADHD dead zone.
The boring task paradox. If the task were genuinely engaging, debugging code, writing something, even a video game, the stimulation itself might be enough to hold attention without needing hyperfocus. And in those cases, having Hannah nearby might actually be fine, or even preferable, because the social presence adds a layer of accountability or shared space without breaking flow.
Packing cables doesn't generate its own stimulation, so the brain needs to borrow stimulation from somewhere, either from hyperfocus, which requires solitude to initiate, or from external sources like a podcast or music. Without either of those, you're just a person staring at a tangle of USB cables feeling vaguely inadequate.
That's the trap Daniel's describing. He knows the task needs to get done. He knows he's capable of doing it efficiently. But the conditions aren't right for his brain to engage the mechanism that would let him do it efficiently. So he's stuck.
Which brings us to the emotional layer, because understanding the neuroscience doesn't make the feeling go away. Daniel wrote this prompt knowing Hannah might hear it. That takes a certain amount of vulnerability. I need you to not exist for 2 hours is a hard thing to say to someone you love, even when you know it's not about them.
I think part of what makes it hard is that we've culturally coded the need for solitude as either antisocial or as a luxury preference. I focus better alone sounds like I prefer being alone, which sounds like I prefer being alone to being with you. But that's not what's happening. This is a needs versus wants distinction. Daniel isn't choosing solitude over connection. His brain requires solitude as a precondition for certain types of task completion. It's not a preference. It's more like needing glasses to read.
The glasses analogy is good. Nobody feels guilty about needing glasses. Nobody's partner feels rejected because they need corrective lenses. But I need the house empty to back cables. Feels different because it involves another person's behavior, not just your own accommodation.
There's another layer here that's specific to ADHD brains, the anticipatory interruption loop. If you've spent your life being pulled out of focus unexpectedly, your brain develops a kind of hypervigilance. It learns that deep focus is dangerous because the interruption is coming, it's just a matter of when. So the brain preemptively reduces focus depth as a protective measure. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You can't focus deeply because you're waiting to be interrupted. And you're waiting to be interrupted because past experience has taught you that deep focus gets punished.
That's almost tragic. The brain learns to not fully commit to anything because commitment has historically been penalized.
It doesn't matter that Hannah is considerate and wouldn't interrupt unnecessarily. The hypervigilance isn't responding to her specifically. It's responding to a lifetime of accumulated interruption experiences. The monitoring thread doesn't care that this particular person is trustworthy. It just knows a person is present, and persons have historically been sources of interruption.
Even if Hannah has never once interrupted Daniel while he's packing Gables, his brain is still running the monitoring thread, because the pattern is deeper than any specific relationship.
And this is where I want to distinguish something important. The cognitive load of social presence doesn't necessarily decrease with familiarity. For neurodivergent brains especially, it can be a constant baseline drain regardless of relationship quality. Loving someone more doesn't reduce the monitoring thread. It might even increase it, because you care more about being responsive to them.
That's a cruel irony. The more you care about someone, the more attentional resources your brain might allocate to monitoring their potential needs. So the very thing that makes the relationship strong, caring about being available, is also what makes focus harder.
There's a concept in the literature called social satiety, the point at which social interaction has provided enough stimulation and the brain is ready to disengage. For neurotypical brains, social satiety operates kind of like hunger. You get enough, you feel full, you can move on to other things. For many ADHD brains, social satiety doesn't work the same way. The monitoring system doesn't get full. It just keeps running.
Daniel's brain isn't just monitoring for interruption. It's monitoring for connection opportunities, for questions, for needs, for the thousand tiny social signals that maintain a shared household. And it's doing this while also trying to remember which cable goes in which section of the box.
Here's the thing about open loops, a concept from productivity psychology that applies especially hard to ADHD brains. An open loop is any unresolved commitment that consumes background processing. Hannah might need something, is an open loop. I should check if she needs help with the move, is an open loop. What if she wants to ask me something, is an open loop. The presence of another person creates open loops by default, and ADHD brains struggle disproportionately with closing them.
Can you close them without physical solitude? Is there a way to say, the loop is closed? I am officially unavailable. That actually works at the neural level?
The research on this is more anecdotal than clinical, but there's a consistent pattern in ADHD coaching and therapy around what's called explicit unavailability. Before starting a task, you state clearly, I'm going to be unavailable for the next 90 minutes. Unless the house is on fire, please don't interrupt. I'll come find you when I'm done. The explicit closure of the loop can reduce the anticipatory load even if the person stays in the house.
Because now the brain has a rule instead of an open question. She might need something, gets replaced with, she knows I'm unavailable, and we've agreed on the conditions for interruption.
It doesn't eliminate the monitoring thread entirely, but it reduces it. The brain can offload some of the vigilance onto the agreement itself. It's not as effective as physical solitude, but it's a meaningful improvement for situations where getting the house to yourself isn't practical.
Which brings us to the practical question Daniel's really asking underneath all of this. How do you explain this to a partner without it sounding like rejection? Because I need you to not exist for 2 hours is honest, but it's not exactly diplomatic.
The frame matters enormously. If you present it as a preference, I just focus better alone. It sounds like you're ranking solitude above the person. If you present it as a cognitive requirement, my brain literally cannot engage the focus mechanism when another person is present, and here's the neuroscience of why. It becomes a shared problem to solve, rather than a personal rejection.
It's not you, it's my anterior cingulate cortex.
I mean, unironically, yes. Giving your partner the vocabulary, anticipatory cognitive load, monitoring thread, hyperfocus fragility, turns it from, I don't want you around, into, here's what my brain is doing, and I need your help creating the conditions where I can function.
I think for Hannah specifically, who's an architect, the framing might actually resonate. She understands that you can't build a structure without the right foundation conditions. You don't pour concrete on unstable ground and blame the concrete when it cracks. Daniel's brain needs specific environmental conditions to support certain types of cognitive work. That's not a character flaw.
The other piece is making the unavailability bounded and predictable. I need you to not exist. feels very different from, I need 90 minutes of solitude, and then I'm yours. The first sounds like rejection. The second sounds like scheduling. One is about pushing away. The other is about creating a container for focus that has a clear end.
The end matters because it closes the loop for the partner too. Anna's not wondering, is he going to be unavailable all day? Should I just leave him alone indefinitely? She knows there's a specific window, and after that window, connection resumes. That's easier to not take personally.
Let me address something Daniel said that I think a lot of people with ADHD will recognize. He mentioned that when he's in a flow state and focused, this isn't an issue. But packing cables isn't flow. Flow states, in the Csikszentmihalyi sense, require a balance of challenge and skill, clear goals, immediate feedback. Packing cables has none of that. It's low challenge, low feedback, ambiguous completion criteria. It's the exact opposite of a flow-inducing activity.
He's trying to do a task that his brain finds profoundly understimulating, while also running a social monitoring thread, while also managing the open loops of a house move. And he's wondering why it's hard.
The remarkable thing isn't that he needs solitude to do it. The remarkable thing is that anyone can do it at all.
Let's talk about the neurotypical comparison directly, because Daniel asked whether this is universal. And the answer is yes and no. The mechanism, anticipatory cognitive load from background social presence, is universal. Every human brain does some version of this. It's probably evolutionary. If you're in a social group, monitoring for social cues and potential threats from or to group members is adaptive.
The severity is where ADHD diverges. For a neurotypical brain, the background person adds friction. Task completion takes longer, maybe 15% longer. Quality might dip slightly. It's annoying. For an ADHD brain, the same condition can be disabling. Not, I'm slower, but I cannot start. Not, this is harder, but this is impossible right now.
That distinction matters for how we think about accommodations. If it were just a preference, you could reasonably say, just push through it. But if it's a prerequisite for task initiation, pushing through isn't an option. The engine doesn't turn over.
There's a parallel here to the open office debate that I think is useful. Neurotypical workers in open offices report lower satisfaction and higher distraction, but most can still produce work. Many ADHD workers report that open offices make deep work literally impossible, not harder, impossible. Same environment, same mechanism, different severity of impact.
The response to that is often, well, you just need to learn to focus with distractions, which is like telling someone who needs glasses to just try harder to see. The hardware is different. No amount of effort changes the dopamine signaling in your prefrontal cortex.
This is where I want to be careful not to over-pathologize. Daniel's experience isn't a disorder. It's his brain operating exactly as an ADHD brain operates under these conditions. The goal isn't to fix it. It's to understand it well enough to design around it.
Design around it. That's the architectural framing again. What would it look like to design your home and your routines and your relationships around your actual cognitive needs, rather than around what you think you should be able to handle?
That question applies whether you have ADHD or not. Everyone has cognitive needs. Everyone has conditions under which they function better or worse. The difference is that for neurotypical people, the gap between optimal conditions and suboptimal conditions is smaller, so they can get away with ignoring it. For ADHD brains, the gap is wide enough that ignoring it means things don't get done.
To Daniel's question, is this just a me thing? The answer is, the feeling is universal, but the intensity is ADHD specific. Everyone has experienced wanting solitude to focus. Not everyone has experienced being unable to focus at all without it. Your brain isn't broken. It's just running a different operating system, and this particular task requires a specific configuration.
That configuration includes solitude, not because you don't love Hannah, but because your brain's social monitoring system doesn't have an off switch. It can access while another person is present. The monitoring thread runs on hardware, not intention. You can't decide to stop running it any more than you can decide to stop your heart from beating.
I think that's the thing to sit with. The guilt Daniel feels, I love my wife, why do I need her gone to function, is based on a misunderstanding of what's happening. He's treating a hardware limitation as if it were an emotional preference. If your leg is broken, you don't feel guilty about needing crutches. If your brain can't suppress the social monitoring thread without physical solitude, that's not a statement about your relationships. It's a statement about your neurology.
Here's the hopeful part. Once you understand the mechanism, you can work with it instead of against it. You can have the conversation with your partner that's grounded in neuroscience rather than in, "I just need space." You can experiment with explicit unavailability agreements. You can recognize the boring task trap and either change the conditions or pair the task with stimulation. You can stop blaming yourself for having a brain that works the way brains work.
You can send your wife a podcast episode that explains it better than you could in the moment, which I suspect might be part of what's happening here.
Daniel, we see you.
So let's get into the actual mechanics. Why does a silent person in another room feel like a barrier to focus? What's happening at the neural level when that monitoring thread fires up?
The key player here is the prefrontal cortex and its role in maintaining task sets. A task set is essentially the neural configuration that lets you execute a specific activity, all the rules, goals, and procedures loaded into working memory. When you're packing cables, your task set includes things like USB-C cables go in this section, label as you go, coil clockwise to prevent tangling. Your brain is holding that configuration active.
The monitoring thread is a second task, set running simultaneously.
A social monitoring task set. Is Hannah approaching? Did she say something? Does she look like she might need help? Is that a question in her body language? Even if none of those things are happening, the task set is loaded and consuming resources. The prefrontal cortex is doing something called dual task interference, is trying to maintain two task sets at once, and they compete for the same limited working memory capacity. The dual task interference is what makes alone in the house feel so qualitatively different from alone in a room. When you're truly alone, the social monitoring task set never loads. Your prefrontal cortex can dedicate itself entirely to the cable packing task set. The moment another person is present, the social task set loads automatically. Not because you decided to load it, but because human brains are wired for social attunement. We evolved in groups. Monitoring conspecifics is a default setting.
There's a word that's never been spoken in a love poem.
Yet it's exactly the right word here. The monitoring thread doesn't care that the conspecific is your beloved wife. It just registers human present and allocates resources accordingly. That 10-15% working memory overhead I mentioned earlier, that's not a metaphor. It's measurable in fMRI studies. You can watch the prefrontal cortex lighting up for the primary task and simultaneously see activation in regions associated with social cognition and vigilance.
The distinction from simple distraction is important. Distraction is when something actually happens. A noise, a question, a door opening. This is anticipatory. Nothing is happening, and that's the problem. The brain is spending resources preparing for something that might happen, and those resources aren't available for the thing that needs to happen.
And that's why noise-canceling headphones don't fully solve this. They block auditory distraction, but they don't close the monitoring thread. Your brain still knows someone is in the house. The thread runs on presence, not on sensory input.
Which also explains why this gets worse with boring tasks specifically. If Daniel were doing something engaging, something that naturally recruits the task-positive network and suppresses the default mode, the monitoring thread might still be running, but the primary task would be strong enough to dominate. Packing cables doesn't recruit enough neural resources to outcompete the social monitoring. The boring task loses the tug of war for working memory.
That's the piece that makes this not just "I prefer quiet." Quiet is about sensory input. This is about cognitive architecture. The brain has a fixed working memory budget, and the social monitoring thread is a non-negotiable line item whenever another person is present. For a neurotypical brain, that line item is small enough that the boring task still gets funded. For an ADHD brain, the boring task was already underfunded because of the dopamine issue, and the monitoring thread pushes it below the threshold for execution.
We're not talking about a preference for solitude. We're talking about a prerequisite for task initiation on low stimulation activities. The monitoring thread is the reason the engine won't start, not the reason it runs rough once it's going. Walk me through the actual switching cost. You mentioned the default mode network and the task positive network. What's happening in an ADHD brain when it tries to move between monitoring Hannah and backing cables? That's different from a neurotypical brain.
The core problem is dopamine. The prefrontal cortex uses dopamine to signal this task set is the one we're keeping active, suppress the others. In an ADHD brain, that dopamine signal is weaker. So when you try to switch from the social monitoring task set to the cable packing task set, the suppression of the monitoring thread is incomplete. It keeps bubbling back up. The brain can't fully commit to the switch.
It's not that the switch takes longer. It's that the switch never fully completes.
And the January 2026 analysis in Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews quantified part of this. ADHD brains show about 40% greater activation in the anterior cingulate cortex during task switching compared to neurotypical controls. The ACC is your brain's conflict detector. It fires when two competing demands are active simultaneously. 40% more activation means the ADHD brain is working significantly harder just to manage the transition between task sets.
That's before any actual interruption happens. That's just the cost of knowing an interruption is possible.
Before anything happens, the ACC is responding to the mere presence of competing task sets, social monitoring versus cable sorting. And because the dopamine signal isn't strong enough to fully suppress the social monitoring, the ACC keeps flagging the conflict. It's like a pop-up window that won't stay closed.
Which brings us to hyperfocus, because that's supposed to be the ADHD brain's solution to this problem. When the hyperfocus engages, the default mode network gets suppressed. The task-positive network dominates, and suddenly you're productive in a way that looks almost effortless from the outside.
Here's what most people get wrong about hyperfocus. It's not a superpower you can summon. It's a state that occurs under specific environmental conditions, and it's fragile in ways that neurotypical flow states aren't. The presence of another person creates what researchers call a permeable boundary around the focus zone. Your brain never fully disengages the social monitoring system, so the default mode network never fully suppresses. And without full suppression of the default mode, hyperfocus simply doesn't initiate.
The monitoring thread doesn't just compete with the task, it blocks the mechanism that would let the task dominate.
Hyperfocus requires the brain to make a binary choice. This task, nothing else. The presence of another person makes that binary choice impossible because monitor for social cues is a non-negotiable background process. You can't opt out of it. So the brain never makes the full commitment hyperfocus requires.
That's why Daniel can't just try harder to focus. The mechanism he needs to engage, hyperfocus, as compensation for low task stimulation, is structurally unavailable when someone else is in the house.
And this connects directly to the boring task paradox. Packing cables is in this specific dead zone. It requires enough cognitive engagement that you can't do it on autopilot. You're making categorization decisions, remembering which cable goes where, planning the box layout. But it's not engaging enough to naturally hold attention. There's no problem to solve, no novelty, no feedback loop. It's the exact kind of task where an ADHD brain needs hyperfocus to compensate, and it's also the exact kind of task where the conditions for hyperfocus are hardest to achieve.
Compare that to something like debugging code or writing. Those tasks generate their own stimulation. There's a problem, there's progress, there's a dopamine hit when something works. The task itself can hold attention without needing hyperfocus to kick in.
In those cases, having Hannah nearby might actually be fine. The social monitoring thread is still running, but the primary task is strong enough to dominate working memory anyway. The brain doesn't need to fully suppress the default mode to stay engaged, because the task is intrinsically rewarding. Daniel might even prefer having her nearby during engaging work. It adds a layer of shared presence without breaking anything.
Packing cables has no intrinsic reward. There's no dopamine in deciding whether this particular USB cable goes in section A or section B. So the brain looks for stimulation elsewhere, and the only available source would be hyperfocus, which requires solitude to initiate. No solitude, no hyperfocus. No hyperfocus, no task completion. You're just a person staring at cables.
That's the trap. The boring task paradox means the less engaging the task, the more you need hyperfocus. But the more you need hyperfocus, the more fragile the conditions have to be. A high stimulation task can tolerate background presence. A low stimulation task cannot. And the lowest stimulation tasks, packing, organizing, filing are exactly the ones where the solitude requirement is most absolute.
Which is the opposite of how most people think about it. The assumption is that boring tasks should be easier to do with someone around, because the task is simple. But for an ADHD brain, boring tasks are the ones that require the most environmental support. The complexity of the task is almost irrelevant. The stimulation level is everything.
There's a clinical observation I used to see in practice. Parents would bring in a kid with ADHD and say he can play video games for 6 hours straight but can't do 15 minutes of homework, and they'd interpret that as a motivation problem. But it's not motivation. It's that the video game provides high-density stimulation that naturally recruits and holds attention. Homework provides almost none. The kid isn't choosing to focus on games and not on homework. The games are doing the work of holding attention. The homework requires the kid to do that work himself, and his brain isn't equipped for it without specific conditions.
Daniel packing cables is the adult version of that. He's not unmotivated. He wants the task done. He knows how to do it efficiently. But the task provides zero help in holding his attention, and the presence of another person removes the one compensatory mechanism his brain has, hyperfocus.
The cable packing scenario is almost a perfect case study. It requires categorization decisions. This cable goes with that device, these go in this section of the box, but there's no deep problem solving. It's repetitive but not fully automatable. It's the ADHD dead zone. Too complex for autopilot, too boring for engagement. And the only way through that dead zone for an ADHD brain is hyperfocus, which requires solitude.
When Daniel says he needs the house empty, he's not being dramatic. He's accurately describing the environmental precondition for the only cognitive strategy that works for this kind of task.
That's where the guilt comes in, because understanding the mechanism doesn't silence the voice that says a good husband should be able to focus with his wife in the house. That voice is loud, and it's wrong, but it's persistent.
The voice is wrong because it's confusing two completely separate systems. Loving someone is an emotional and relational fact. Needing solitude to engage a specific cognitive mechanism is a hardware requirement. They don't trade off against each other. You can be deeply in love and also need the house empty to pack cables. One has nothing to do with the other.
Culturally, we've bundled them together. We treat the desire for solitude as a measure of how much you value connection. Wanting to be alone means you don't want to be with people, which means you don't want to be with the specific person you love. That chain of inference is automatic and it's completely invalid, but it runs anyway.
For Daniel, who wrote this knowing Hannah might hear it, there's a vulnerability in admitting it publicly. He's essentially saying, I love you. And also my brain doesn't fully register you as separate from potential interruption when I'm trying to do boring tasks. That's a hard thing to say out loud.
And the reason it's hard is that it sounds like a failure of intimacy. If you really loved someone, shouldn't their presence be comforting rather than distracting? Shouldn't familiarity reduce the monitoring load? That's the intuitive assumption, and it's wrong for ADHD brains specifically.
Wait, say more about that. Why doesn't familiarity reduce the load?
Because the social monitoring threat isn't responding to threat or novelty. It's not saying, who is this person? Are they dangerous? It's saying, a human is present. Maintain readiness for interaction. Familiarity might actually increase the load, because you care more about being responsive to someone you love. The monitoring isn't vigilance against a stranger. It's attunement to someone whose needs matter to you. That doesn't diminish with time. It might intensify.
The more you love someone, the more attentional resources you might unconsciously allocate to monitoring their state. The thing that makes the relationship good is also what makes the cognitive load higher.
And that's the cruel irony I mentioned. For neurotypical brains, this effect is small enough to be manageable. For ADHD brains, where attentional resources are already constrained by dopamine signaling, it can be the difference between functioning and not. Loving someone more doesn't fix the dopamine problem. It just raises the stakes.
Let's talk about the anticipatory interruption loop, because I think this is where the emotional weight really accumulates. It's not just that Daniel's brain is monitoring Hannah right now. It's that his brain has a lifetime of data suggesting that deep focus gets interrupted.
The loop works like this. You've been pulled out of focus unexpectedly hundreds or thousands of times by parents, teachers, colleagues, partners. Each time the interruption is jarring. You lose your train of thought, you can't get back in, the task doesn't get done. Over time, your brain learns a protective strategy. Don't fully commit to focus in the first place. Stay ready to pivot. If you never go deep, you can't be hurt by being pulled out.
The brain preemptively sabotages its own focus as a defense mechanism. That's almost elegant in its dysfunction.
It's adaptive, in a maladaptive way. The brain is trying to protect you from the pain of interruption by never letting you get invested enough to be interrupted. And it doesn't matter that Hannah specifically has never interrupted Daniel while packing cables. The pattern is older than this relationship. The monitoring thread runs on the category person present, not on the specific person's interruption history.
Which means even if Hannah is the most considerate partner in the world, and by all accounts she is, Daniel's brain is still running the monitoring thread at full capacity, because the thread isn't about her. It's about a lifetime of accumulated experience that the brain has generalized into a rule. Person equals potential interruption, so stay shallow.
That's what makes this so hard to explain to a partner. If you say, "I can't focus when you're here," the natural response is, "But I'm not doing anything, I'm being quiet, what am I doing wrong?" And the answer is, nothing, you're doing nothing wrong. The problem isn't your behavior. It's the automatic process in my brain that doesn't distinguish between you and anyone else who's ever interrupted me. That's a terrible thing to have to say to someone you love.
And yet not saying it is worse, because then the partner fills in the blank with the worst possible interpretation. He can't focus when I'm around, becomes I'm annoying, becomes he doesn't want me here. The silence is more damaging than the awkward truth.
How do you actually have this conversation? Because I need you to not exist for 90 minutes is honest but undiplomatic, and my anterior cingulate cortex shows 40% greater activation during task switching is accurate but not exactly pillow talk.
I think the script has to do three things simultaneously. It has to name the need clearly. It has to locate the cause in your neurology, not in the other person's behavior. And it has to be bounded. Specific duration. Specific endpoint. Specific reconnection.
Something like, I'm going to put my phone on do not disturb and close the door. I'm not ignoring you. I'm trying to get into a state where I can finish this task efficiently. When I'm done, I'll come find you.
That's good. It's clear, it's bounded, and it frames the solitude as a temporary tool for a specific purpose rather than a general preference for being alone.
The endpoint matters enormously. When I'm done, I'll come find you. Closes the loop for the partner, too. She's not left wondering whether she should avoid you indefinitely or whether you're upset. There's a clear reconnection built into the agreement.
I think another useful move is to give the partner the vocabulary. If Hannah understands what anticipatory cognitive load is, she can reframe the situation herself. It stops being he doesn't want me around, and becomes his brain is running a monitoring thread that consumes working memory, and solitude is how he turns it off. That's not personal. That's just neurology.
For Hannah specifically, who's an architect, the framing might actually land naturally. She understands that you can't build on unstable ground. You don't get frustrated at the foundation for needing the right conditions. You just create the conditions. Daniel's brain needs specific environmental conditions for certain types of cognitive work. That's not a character flaw. It's not a relationship problem. It's just a fact about how his particular brain operates.
There's a case study I've heard from listeners that I think is instructive here. A couple negotiated what they called focus blocks, 90-minute periods where both of them wear noise-canceling headphones and agree not to interrupt unless it's an actual emergency. The agreement itself reduced the anticipatory load even though the partner was still physically in the house.
Because the explicit agreement closed the open loop, the brain could offload some of the vigilance onto the contract. She might need something. Got replaced with, she's agreed not to need anything for 90 minutes unless the house is on fire. That's a closed loop. The monitoring thread doesn't disappear, but it dials down significantly.
That's the key insight about open loops. ADHD brains struggle disproportionately with unresolved commitments. Hannah might need something. Is an open loop. I should check if she needs help with the move. Is an open loop. What if she wants to ask me something? Is an open loop. The presence of another person creates open loops by default, and they consume background processing until they're explicitly closed.
the explicit unavailability agreement, I'm unavailable until 3, here are the emergency conditions, I'll find you when I'm done, is one of the most reliable ways to close those loops without physical solitude. It's not as effective as having the house to yourself, but it's a meaningful improvement for situations where solitude isn't practical.
Which brings us to the neurotypical comparison Daniel asked about directly.
Let's get practical. Understanding the mechanism is one thing, but Daniel's in the middle of a house move. He needs to pack cables. What does he actually do?
First thing is name the need explicitly. Not, I need some quiet, or I'm going to focus for a bit. Those are vague enough that they don't close the loop. I need the house to myself for 90 minutes is harder to say, but it's also clearer. And if you give Hannah the term anticipatory cognitive load, she has a concrete concept to work with, instead of filling in the blank with, he doesn't want me here.
The vocabulary matters more than people think. My brain runs a monitoring thread when another person is present, and it consumes about 10 to 15% of my working memory. It's specific and impersonal. It's not about her. It's about a process that would fire for anyone.
Second thing. And this one works even if you can't get the house empty, is explicit unavailability. Before you start the task, say it out loud. I'm going to be unavailable for the next hour. Unless the house is on fire, please don't interrupt. I'll come find you when I'm done. The act of stating it closes the open loop. Your brain can offload some of the vigilance onto the agreement itself.
The I'll come find you part is doing real neurological work. It gives the monitoring thread a termination condition. You're not saying leave me alone indefinitely. You're saying here's the container, here's when it ends, here's when I re-engage. That's a closed loop for both of you.
Third thing is recognizing the boring task trap for what it is. If you're stuck on a low stimulation task and can't focus, the solution is almost never try harder. Trying harder with an ADHD brain on a boring task is like pressing the gas pedal when the engine's flooded. What you need is to change the conditions. If you can't get solitude, pair the task with something that raises the stimulation floor. A podcast, an audiobook, music that occupies just enough bandwidth to keep the dopamine flowing without hijacking the task entirely.
That's the counterintuitive part. Adding stimulation to a task that already feels overwhelming can actually make it easier, because the extra stimulation is what lets the prefrontal cortex lock on. The boring task alone doesn't provide enough dopamine. The boring task plus a podcast might.
The fourth thing, and this is the one I think Daniel most needs to hear, is separate, the guilt from the need. Needing solitude to function is not a rejection of Hannah. It's not a statement about the relationship. It's a cognitive requirement, like needing glasses to read. Nobody feels guilty about glasses. Nobody's partner feels rejected because their spouse needs corrective lenses. Frame it as a need, not a preference, and the guilt starts to dissolve.
The glasses analogy is the one I'd tell Daniel to keep in his back pocket. It's immediate, it's concrete, and it short-circuits the chain of inference that goes from, I need solitude, to, I don't love you. You wouldn't say, if you really loved me, you'd be able to see without glasses. The hardware is the hardware.
To bring it back to where we started, Daniel packing cables, needing the house to himself, wondering if this makes him a bad husband. It doesn't. It makes him someone with an ADHD brain who's accurately identified the environmental conditions he needs for a specific type of task. That's not a flaw. That's self-awareness.
To Daniel's original question, is this just a me thing? The answer is no, but the intensity is what makes it ADHD specific. The mechanism is universal. Every human brain runs some version of the social monitoring thread. It's probably evolutionary. If you're in a group, tracking conspecifics is adaptive. But for most people, the thread is a minor background process. Annoying, not disabling. For the ADHD brain, that same thread can be the difference between a task getting done and a task never starting.
The universal part matters because it means Daniel isn't some outlier whose brain is uniquely broken. He's experiencing an amplified version of something everyone knows. The amplification is real, and it's tied to dopamine and the anterior cingulate and all the hardware we've talked about. But the core experience, needing solitude to lock into a boring task, is recognizable to pretty much anyone who's ever tried to do their taxes with someone else in the room.
The difference is that for a neurotypical person, the background presence is friction. For Daniel, it's a wall. Same mechanism, different severity. And once you understand that, you stop asking, why can't I just push through this? And start asking, what conditions does my brain actually need?
Which I think is the real question to sit with. Not what's wrong with me, but what would it look like to design your home and your relationships around your actual cognitive needs, rather than what you think you should be able to handle?
That's the architectural question Hannah would probably appreciate. You don't blame the foundation for needing level ground, you level the ground.
If this episode landed for you, if you've ever needed someone you love to not exist for 90 minutes so you could pack cables or do taxes or just think, send it to them. Sometimes the neuroscience is easier to hear than I need space. And if you've got a weird prompt of your own, send it in. We read everyone.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. We're at myweirdprompts.com.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.